Let's do it. It's go time.
Welcome to Go Time, your source for wide-ranging discussions from all around the Go community. If you like this show, you'll love The Changelog. It's news on Mondays, deep technical interviews on Wednesdays, and on Fridays, an awesome talk show for your weekend enjoyment. Find us by searching for The Changelog wherever you listen to podcasts. Big thanks to our partners at Fly.io. Launch your app in 5 minutes or less all around the world. Learn how at Fly.io. Okay, here we go.
What's up, friends? I'm here with Kurt Mackey, co-founder and CEO of Fly. As you know, we love Fly. That is the home of changelog.com. But Kurt, I want to know how you explain Fly to developers. Do you tell them a story first? How do you do it?
I kind of change how I explain it based on almost like the generation of developer I'm talking to. So like for me, I built and shipped apps on Heroku, which if you've never used Heroku is roughly like building and shipping an app on Vercel today. It's just, it's 2024 instead of 2008 or whatever. And what frustrated me about doing that was I got stuck. You can build and ship a Rails app with a Postgres on Heroku, the same way you can build and ship a Next.js app on Vercel. But as soon as you want to do something interesting, like as soon as you want to, at the time, I think one of the things I ran into is like, I wanted to add what used to be like kind of the basis for Elasticsearch. I want to do full text search in my applications. You kind of hit this wall with something like Heroku where you can't really do that. I think lately we've seen it with like people wanting to add LLMs, kind of inference stuff to their applications on Vercel or Heroku or Cloudflare or whoever these days. They've started like releasing abstractions that sort of let you do this, but I can't just run the model I'd run locally on these black box platforms that are very specialized. For the people my age, it's always like, oh, Heroku was great, but I outgrew it. And one of the things that I felt like I should be able to do when I was using Heroku was like run my app close to people in Tokyo for users that were in Tokyo. And that was never possible. For modern generation devs, it's a lot more Vercel based. It's a lot like Vercel is great right up until you hit one of their hard line boundaries. And then you're kind of stuck. There's the other one, we've had someone within the company, I can't remember the name of this game, but the tagline was like 5 minutes to start, forever to master. It's sort of how we're pitching Fly, is like you can get an app going in 5 minutes, but there's so much depth to the platform that you're never gonna run out of things you can do with it.
So unlike AWS or Heroku or Vercel, which are all great platforms, the cool thing we love here at Changelog most about Fly is that no matter what we want to do on the platform, we have primitives, we have abilities, and we as developers can charge our own mission on Fly. It is a no limits platform built for developers, and we think you should try it out. Go to fly.io to learn more. Launch your app in 5 minutes. Too easy. Once again, fly.io.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome, listener, to another episode of Go Time, where we talk about Go, obviously, and Go-adjacent things. Today, I'm joined... Oh, yeah, I'm Johnny. I always forget to introduce myself. I've been doing this long enough, and I always forget. Today, I'm joined by someone who definitely remembers his own name, Wesley Barry. How you doing, Wesley?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. So... the reason why you and I are talking today is because of an interesting journey you've been on building CLI, right? And we'll talk about sort of what you're building the CLI tooling for. But I found sort of your journey interesting because you're kind of not using sort of the standard, you know, like off-the-shelf community projects to do things. You kind of went your own way, so to speak, right? So I wanted to sort of get you on the show for us to talk about sort of basically how did you crawl, walk, run your way to a usable CLI for what you're trying to build? But before we get into that, yeah, give us a little intro. What have you been up to? What are you working on? Where do you work at? What that sort of thing?
Sure. So I've been at this kind of thing for a little while now. My first big exposure to doing CLI stuff was back in the day when I first joined Heroku. My first year or so there was working on the Heroku CLI, which was all in Ruby, actually, which had its own ups and downs, pluses and minuses. I mean, distributing it was not a fun time, but, you know, like working in Ruby was pretty pleasant overall. I still am more Rubyist than anything else, I think. These days, yeah, I work at Anchor, where I do CLI work as well as API work mostly, as well as leading the team because there's five of us. So we all have a lot of hats to wear. So just helping keep engineering on track and moving it forward and doing our best to provide a great CLI experience for making encryption not be terrible because, you know, some existing things like, you know, trying to use OpenSSL directly and stuff is, at least for me, has always been nightmarish. I can never remember what does what, and I have to go look back at my notes or something to figure out the magic spell I cast the last time with OpenSSL that got me what I needed, kind of thing, you know? So,
yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Actually, we actually had an episode about Anchor on the show. I'll put a link to the episode in the show notes. Yeah, we talked about sort of what Anchor is and does, so we don't have to get too deep into that product on this episode. But and yeah, we're both sort of Heroku alumni, so that's always fun. Basically, can you get in a little bit into what you set out to build? Like what made it sort of a non-trivial CLI tool, right? It's something that you could just throw, you know, the standard library at or something like that. What did you set out to build?
Sure. I mean, there are some parts. I mean, like we are in Go because we wanted to be able to distribute more easily, at least in part. And also because the CTO who was on the show previously was much more comfortable in Go than I am. Like this is my first exposure to Go also, for better or worse. That might have some to do with why some of the standard libraries didn't play out the way that you might expect, is because I was trying to figure out how to even do this thing. But yeah, a lot of the goal was really to just provide the best possible user experience we could. And so, you know, once we got past distribution and some other things, then I kind of started to try to figure out, like, given some of the things that I want to do, how can we even do it? Like what tools are available? What's going to work? What's not going to work? And the other thing too, is like, we're a really small team. And we want to be able to move quickly. And so some of it was also a question of how do we quickly iterate? Because we're going to, you know, we want to add stuff, but we're probably going to do it wrong the first time, especially right now as we're still discovering what it is that we're even going to do. And so how do we, you know, iterate as quickly as possible and not waste a lot of time and effort building out stuff that maybe we're going to realize was the wrong path anyway and have to throw out? So yeah, kind of all of those things came together in a way that made it challenging to just use the standard library like stuff and this, you know, more standard based stuff out of the box. I don't know, for me especially, I think one of the biggest challenges I had was just looking at existing Bubble Tea and other stuff in that space was finding good examples of test coverage that were satisfying, that like I felt like I could emulate or use something similar. Like a lot of the examples and things from Charm and a lot of the other examples I saw just had, you know, maybe unit tests or something, but not much that really tested what ultimately came out of the CLI on the other side. And that was an ongoing struggle. That's how we ended up doing some of the things that we did, for instance, was because we just had challenges around that. So
if I understand correctly, your tests were basically given a certain input, you're expecting a certain output. You weren't necessarily testing the ability of the tooling to be able to find the right, you know, target, you know, trigger the right function to do the right thing. But basically, ultimately, if I give this input, could I test what this output was? Which it kind of sounds and feels a little bit different than sort of the regular kind of testing you would do, like to test, okay, does the right code get executed, right? But more sure. So, do I get the right output given a certain input? And do I get the right expectation? Is that a little different? That sounds a little different, right?
Yeah, I think maybe. I mean, I think especially as I moved into trying to do some things that were a little bit more complicated in the UX, right? Like it wasn't whether or not that particular thing got called. I wanted to be able to test particular cases within that. And also, you know, working on a team and stuff, like I wanted to hopefully not make it as terrible for myself to review other people's changes to the CLI, where I would have to, you know, like download and install that branch and manually run a bunch of commands to see if it still looked the way that I thought it ought to look, right? I don't know. Some of it I think comes from also my background of, like, again, working on APIs, and there's some similar problems there sometimes, I think, of like trying to keep track of what changes are or aren't being made and what the final results of those changes will be. So there's just like, yeah, kind of a lot of layers. So I wanted to be able to really dig in and look at what those outputs would be and be able to make assertions about it and stuff like that. And really, you know, drill down, nail down that UX, make sure that we don't have regressions around it, things like that.
So for someone who's listening to this episode, you know, and they're hearing, well, we wanted to iterate quickly, and basically keep things simple because there would be changes. Like to me and to them, it might sound like, you know, you'd want to pick up a well-known library like a Cobra or, you know, like, you know, you mentioned Bubble Tea and there are others, right? It sounds like, you know, basically these things might already be familiar enough to a lot of Go developers that would be an easy decision to make, right? Just pick a well-known library and go with it, right? Like, why did you go differently?
Well, I mean, first off, like we do have Cobra and Bubble Tea in the app. Like we are still using those. It was more just there were some, I don't know, sharp edges, rough edges, whatever, like areas where what those were providing to us didn't quite cut it for what we were trying to accomplish, or we weren't quite satisfied with the way that they solved for it. So I think we'll get into it more deeply. Like one of the things we ended up doing relating to some of the testing stuff we were talking about was we now use a lot of golden file stuff. So we basically say, you know, like, here are the different things that we expect to happen in the CLI interaction, like wait for this prompt to appear. And once it does, then type in these characters and press enter, right? And then at the end of it, we can say, okay, now take all of the stuff that happened in the display space and print it out to a file, right? And when I run this in the future, I want you to do that again. And I want you to compare against that file. And I want to know if there's any discrepancies, because if there are, we want to make sure those were intentional. We want to update the files if we need to, all that kind of thing. So, you know, like that Bubble Tea has that is great, but at least last I saw, it was just in an experimental library that Charm ships. It's not really part of the core Bubble Tea. So we had to go hunting a little bit to even find it. And when we did find it, we found that there were some gotchas related to it that made it difficult to use. In particular, there are race conditions basically that come along with it because of the nature of when you are doing things that cause the UX to render more things versus when you actually do the check to see what rendered out. Like a concrete example is we have some places where in the UX, it will say, like, I'm fetching resources from the API. It has a little spinner. You know, it's a pretty common element that you've probably seen in a lot of CLIs. The problem was that from the way that it did its golden file tests in the library from Charm, if that spins just until it finishes and then disappears, depending on how long it takes to disappear on different test runs, it might or might not appear in the golden file output. And so now you have this issue of either we need to, I don't know, like mock it out or something so that we can more consistently know how long it's going to take, or, you know, like it suddenly becomes much more complicated and you need to remember that and deal with that every time you're dealing with a test. And we were not keen on doing that, you know, like that got to be a headache pretty quickly. So we actually like are still doing something that's very similar, that like the core of it is the same thing that they were doing, but we've changed it so that we are making sure that whenever we're rendering something to the screen, we're getting some kind of output related to it into our golden files. So that again, it's like consistent from run to run. There's not those timing inconsistencies, even if things appear and disappear. Every time something has changed, it will appear on the screen. And then because we're already in the mix of doing all of that, it gave us more capabilities that more recently we added, like the ability to redact certain things from the golden files, because in some cases it's like, oh, well, the name that gets placed here is, you know, we randomly generate a value there. So there's not always the same thing. But in terms of the golden file, we just want like a name value to appear there. We don't really care what the name value is. And we don't want that to like write a new golden file or whatever. So since we were already kind of in the guts of things and we already had a pipeline that was touching the golden files, it was pretty easy to make those changes. So, you know, it wasn't that we were like totally starting from scratch. And like, I don't think, or at least I hope I didn't commit the sort of cardinal sin of I came to this language from a different language and I think I know better, right? Like I did try pretty hard to see what was there and try to take from and use it. And then, like I said, it's just like a lot of it got us pretty far along the way, but not quite all the way there. And so what we've done in a lot of cases is just take it and build a little bit more or a little bit different on top of it to just get us, you know, over those little bumps that we ran into along the way.
So I'm going to assume that the CLI has to make sort of network calls to perform certain actions. During your testing, how did that factor into your test? Did you simulate network request responses or did you actually make real network call? How did you handle that?
All of the above, kind of. So there's a couple different things. One of the other things that I initially picked up at my time at Heroku and now I've really dived into is doing more like spec first API development. So when we're working on API endpoints, which for us, a lot of what we're doing is basically like, we want to add a new capability to the CLI, which relates to, you know, like CRUD operations on a resource or something. Well, how are those going to be driven? Well, it's going to be, there's going to be a REST API on the other side, right? So we have our open API spec that defines what all of the API ought to be doing. So usually when I'm going to develop a new endpoint, like I was working on a new thing earlier this week. So I go into the spec, I add in this case, it was a new operation to create organizations. Previously, if you wanted to do that, you had to just go into the web interface. Now I'm trying to add it into CLI. So I went in, I defined it in the spec, and then right now we're using a tool called, hopefully I get all of these right, there's a bunch of tools. So I believe Prism is the right one for that. So Prism is a node-based command line tool, relates to OpenAPI stuff. You spin that up and you can actually say, here is a spec that has example values in it. When I make a post request to the organization's thing to create an organization, just use the example data from this file and return something that, you know, doesn't necessarily quite match up with what I said, but it is a valid representation of an organization. Because for my initial stuff, like, that's fine, right? So usually while I'm developing, I'll start with that. So I'll be developing the spec and developing the CLI in parallel, and then I can actually build out the CLI endpoint that works just against all of these mocked datas, right? And then that I found in terms of iterating and stuff is super valuable, because I don't know about other people, like, even though I've been doing API stuff for a while, I almost never get it right the first time, right? And it's pretty costly if, quote unquote, getting it right the first time means writing out all of the endpoints and all of the backing stuff to that and all of the tests to that and all of the database interactions to that and the tables, you know, all of that stuff. Like, there's a lot of stuff to that. And so if you make a mistake, it can be a real pain to fix it. So being able to just iterate quickly against the spec directly, it's way easier, because I can be like, all right, great, I'll do this, you know, bang it out. I'm working on the CLI endpoint. Oh, wait, like, there's two or three more fields that need to be serialized onto this record that I just forgot about, right? Like, okay, let me go add those to the spec. Great, they're there. Okay, now the CLI thing does everything it needs to. Now I can go do the implementation and I have a clear contract that I'm basically implementing against. So we start with that. And then in the same way, when we're doing tests, we have a lot of tests that are marked to run just in that mocked mode. And so in the test context, we spin up a Prism mock server and we run tests against that. Not everything works that way, because, you know, the example I gave a second ago of like, create an organization, but don't really pay attention to the parameters I pass into you or whatever, just give me back something that's technically valid. Like, for some tests, that's great. That's all you really need. But for other tests, like, it matters that the database really gets touched and the valid records are there. And especially in our context of X509 stuff, I wish it weren't this way, because it can be a real pain. But sometimes to create a valid record, you're actually creating sort of a constellation of records. It's actually like, you know, it's not just this one record that is valid by itself. You need to create these six different records that all have relationships to one another or something, right? And so mocking that becomes a nightmare very quickly, right? So at the same way, we have Prism can also be run in a proxy mode, where instead of being a mock server, it instead passes requests through. But as the requests pass through in both directions, it checks to make sure that everything that's passing through matches against the schema that you provided. So that helps to guard us then that now we're running tests against real live stuff, creating real records or whatever. But if there's discrepancies from that contract that we've written, we'll find out about it, right? So that helps, again, to keep us honest. And then on the server side, we have some similar tooling. So our server in this case is all in Ruby that runs the API. And there's a library that's called Committee that also has the schema loaded into it. It's what's called a rack middleware. So as the requests come in, it checks the request against the schema. And if they don't match, it will reject it and say, hey, you're including a field that's not in the schema. I don't know what to do with that. Like, please don't include this field, or, you know, this is field is the wrong type, or, you know, all these kinds of things that it can find out just from the schema. And on the same token, as the request comes back out, it checks it again against it and says, hey, wait a second, actually, like, you included three fields that aren't in the schema. Like, what's up with that, right? So all of that, like, provides nice guardrails and helps us to iterate faster. And then we don't always do this because we're such a small team, but it can also be really nice in terms of being able to parallelize some of that. Like, once you have a schema that you've agreed upon, like, I can continue working on the CLI and I can potentially hand off the implementation of the API side to one of my colleagues, and we don't even have to talk to each other or whatever. We're not stepping on each other's feet. We're both, you know, implementing against the same contract. As long as the contract stays the same, like, we can do that without even really having to talk. Like, that forms the talking that needs to happen. So all of those aspects have been really nice and definitely have helped us iterate faster. Actually, like, this is a whole other aside, but in some ways I wish that I had something kind of like that schema set up for CLI stuff, right? Where I could kind of define, like, I don't know, somehow like what the CLI ought to eventually do or look like, because then we could work backwards from that. We could have the contract. I haven't seen anything like that. So if anybody knows of something like that, like, please let me know. It seems harder, like, because the ultimate output of the CLI is much more freeform, right? Like, in the case of an API, like, you're talking about JSON blobs in and out. So it seems a lot easier to define something that says like what the shape of those blobs should be, what the types should be, stuff like that, right? CLI is like a bunch of characters on a screen. So what do you even do, right? But yeah, like not having that can make it harder, right? Like there's a lot of just like guess and check. I don't know. I mean, the closest we got is, this is iterated over time, but we do a lot of sketching basically, where a sketch is, in the early days, my sketches were basically like, I would, again, former Rubyist, still Rubyist, whatever. I would write a Ruby program that was just like a bunch of print lines and stuff basically that more or less did something in the shape of what we wanted the CLI to do. So you could just like see it happening dynamically, because in a lot of cases, for me at least, like that would give me a much better sense of like, does this feel right? Does this feel close to right? Does something seem off here? Does it seem too noisy? Does it seem like it's not giving enough feedback? Like, how does this feel, right? I don't know. For me, at least, it's hard to do that without a little bit of poking and prodding, some, you know, just try, guess, check, etc. So yeah, that's been super helpful too in terms of iterating quickly.
So people love their tools and they usually love choosing them and discussing them. And sometimes it is great to see what exact functionality makes the choice obvious. And quite often, JetBrains IDEs come up in such discussions, and they're usually two. And today we're going to take a look at a couple examples where the code base, the tasks, and the developer benefit from IDE features to the extent that a purchase makes 100% sense. User 9302462 has this to say on Reddit, quote, IntelliJ, IDEA, and Goland takes a little bit to get used to, but all the features it includes makes it way more powerful than VS Code. My company uses TypeScript, and we wanted to do a refactor of 100 plus enums across 5 different repos, which means you can't just change the source in one repo, you have to do it in all repos. And the reason for the refactor is we had different devs working on different programs in order to meet a tight deadline, but there was no standard naming convention, which makes it difficult for the front-end folks to work with. No one wanted to take on this task, and it was kicked down the road for a couple weeks. I chose to take it on one day when there would be no more PRs or possible merge conflicts. It took me about 6 hours to change 80 plus values and function signatures across 5 repositories. Across those repositories, I committed changes to 135 files, including unit tests, with everything passing. Now, why did IntelliJ make this better? Why did this IDE shine? The search functions and refactoring ability are absolutely amazing compared to VS Code. Day-to-day use where you write 100 lines or more of code a day, not much of a difference, but when you need to do a lot of stuff fast and perfectly, IntelliJ is the winner every time. Side note, out of 25 plus devs, I'm the only one that uses IntelliJ, and when they saw those huge PRs, I looked like a god. They were completely amazed by it, even though in reality, I'm a slightly above average developer. So the $200 license that I pay for personally for IntelliJ saved me lots of hours, and I look really good to my company, which means for year-end review, it should help me boost my annual increase. So IntelliJ will actually put more money in my pocket because I can take on tasks that others see as impossible or just really, really hard. Now, regarding Go specifically, I do use it all the time in my own projects, which are all Go, similar setup with the multiple repos and about 10,000 lines of code, which I have written by hand. So if I want to do a Saturday afternoon refactor of my code, it's really easy to do and doesn't feel like I have to climb a mountain. I can just drive up it. It still works, but there's way less mental resistance when it comes to making things better. That's why I choose JetBrains IDEs, end quote. Okay, a good next step is to go to jetbrains.com/go or jetbrains.com/idea. Either of those two IDEs are amazing. One for Kotlin, one for Go. Both amazing. Once again, jetbrains.com/idea or jetbrains.com/go. Enjoy.
How have you dealt with sort of the versioning, like in the compatibility between things? Because, you know, I imagine if you're distributing a CLI, there's a possibility that, you know, a customer will have a version of the CLI that doesn't work with the current iteration on the API, right? That has to talk to. How do you handle that?
It's a work in progress. In the very early days, we just said we have a small enough user base or whatever. We're okay with just kind of moving the API and the CLI forward in lockstep, where basically we can just have I mean, in the very early days, we just had where the CLI wouldn't allow you to run commands if you weren't on the latest version, right? That's the very brute force way of just like...
It forces you to upgrade.
Yep. Hey, you aren't on the latest CLI. Sorry, you're going to have to upgrade before you run this command, right? And so one thing that we've done actually as a way to kind of be able to fall back to that if we feel like we absolutely have to, but to not have it be the normal behavior, is now we have where we're able to return to the CLI. This is the minimum acceptable version, right? So if we get to a point where we know we're going to release something big in the API that is a breaking change and we just want to pull everybody forward because we don't want to do that all the time, but sometimes it might be worth it. Like that is our, you know, break glass kind of thing, is to just say, hey, I know previously we said you could be on whatever version of the CLI, but we just made a big change and we do not want to have to deal with the backwards compatibility. It isn't worth it, whatever. So that's one possibility. Similarly, we don't expect anybody else is consuming the API yet. So we're not too worried about making those changes. Like we're controlling sort of both sides of the equation, but that will not always be true, right? And API governance and versioning is, I mean, that's a whole other headache and conversation. But yeah, that's the main thing we're doing. Otherwise, it's similar to other CLIs. If there's a new version, it'll let you know, but it won't make you go to it unless we really feel like it. But yeah, we'll continue to revisit that and see how that works over time. But that's kind of where we're at right now.
So it sounds like you're still sort of iterating, trying to find that sweet spot. Or do you think you found it? And perhaps what would the next step look like? Would you be going back and saying, okay, we've learned a ton, right? We know what works, what doesn't. We know what works for us and what doesn't work for us. Like, would you build it like differently or the quote unquote right way now? Or would you go back and sort of reinvent that wheel? Or how would you next step look like for you?
I mean, it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think relating to some of the golden file stuff we were talking about, right? Like I like not having to deal with those race conditions. And I like having some capabilities to do some of those like redaction or replacement things that weren't otherwise available. Like something like that, I think I would still really want. I mean, even to the point that now when I'm doing sketches, I actually don't do the Ruby file sketches like I used to. I actually will just like basically handwrite golden files. I find that that is like a format that all of us are relatively used to. And again, in terms of being fast and easy and cheap, like it's faster and easier and cheaper to edit a text file than it is to write a Ruby program that sort of kind of spits out something that almost looks like the CLI, but always was kind of imperfect and things anyway. So those things were nice. There are other parts though, where it was a pain, like as you imagine, like as we sometimes deviated from the golden path, you know, the expected standard stuff, like good luck finding an example of how to do something when you wrote your own thing yourself, right? You're not going to go find a blog post or tutorial or something. Like there were some parts where it quickly became pretty painful because we just had to figure it out. I mean, there are still some gotchas related to that, that I'm guessing it has something to do with how we've done something wrong. Like one that's continued to be a pain is, you know, Cobra does command line like flag parsing, right? And so somehow in the way that we've set up our test suite, it doesn't really play nice with the normal flags that you pass to go test, right? So like we basically just can't use those flags because if we try to either, basically we've gone back and forth and tried different things. Either we mess up the actual Cobra tests or we mess up the go test flags, like one or the other doesn't play nice, right? Like it, we just like have tried a number of things and had a real struggle to get both to play nice next to each other. I'm guessing, again, we must have just done something wrong, right? But like, I don't know how we got there, but we haven't been able to like find our way back. So there's some of that. I mean, I think also, as is, you know, frequently a problem that folks run into, like there's a few places where we have some abstractions into generics and things to try to make things simpler that I'm not sure succeeded in making things simpler. Like there's maybe less code duplication than there would be otherwise, but boy, when something goes wrong, it can be so much harder to actually understand what's going on and how to fix it versus, you know, just having more duplication, having more boilerplate, that sort of thing. Like, not that we should never do the generics, but I think there's a few places where I'm like, I wish we would have waited a little bit longer because I think we would have been better off maintaining two or three parallel implementations of this for a little bit longer until we had a stronger idea of exactly what the abstraction should be like. So, you know, there's some of those things, but I think some of that would likely have come along even if we hadn't deviated as much from these common things. I mean, the other thing too is like some of this question you would have to ask Ben, the CTO that you guys had on before, because he just doesn't like the way that Cobra and Bubble Tea did certain things. And so sometimes that's influenced what we did too, of not that it isn't there, not that it doesn't technically work, but just like it isn't how he would do it, right? So there's a few things that I think we've kind of gone our own way a little bit just because like he would prefer to have it be a little bit more, yeah, just structured a little differently, factored a little bit differently, that kind of thing. So
is the API, how much effort do you put into having the API, or rather the CLI, I should say, sort of a help somebody who's learning to use a CLI, who wants to use a CLI to interact with their content and whatnot? Is it self-documenting? Like when you try to do something, does it tell you, you know, what you're doing wrong or something like that? Or do you need to have sort of a README or a guide or a documentation site hand in hand to be able to use it properly?
Sure. I'm definitely not a documentation site alongside as much as possible. I've pushed, I think, extra far in the other direction, I might say. So we've done a lot of things that I don't know, I think are interesting and compelling that relate to that. So like a really concrete example that like has bugged me with other CLIs is in our CLI, stepping away from CLIs even, like if you go to a website and you try to go to a page that requires authentication and you're not authenticated, like I think we're kind of used to like what happens, right? Do you just see a page that says, you're not authenticated, please go solve this problem and come back to us when you're done, right? No, it redirects you over to the sign-in page, you sign in, and then it redirects you back to where you were and you continue on your way, right? But somehow, and like that never came to CLI land. Like most CLIs that I've interacted with, you try to run an authenticated command and it's like, hey, you're doing this wrong. Like maybe go check the manual or something. Like you're not signed in. Like please go resolve this problem and come back to us when you're ready, right? So that feels like the sort of like more along the lines of like, you need the document hand in hand. You're not going to get anywhere if you don't have it kind of thing, right? Of like, please get your stuff together and come back to us when you actually know what you're doing, right? Like that's very hostile, not helpful. So, you know, in that very narrow example of sign in, right? We have all of our auth commands set up where if you're not signed in, it just says, hey, you know, number one, we can see you're not signed in. Number two, we know how to sign you in. We're well aware of it. So we're actually going to just help you do that, right? We're going to redirect you basically to the sign-in command now. And okay, we finished the sign-in command. Everything went well. Great, you're signed in now. So let's just go right back to where you were because we can have, you know, we're reasonably confident that's what you were trying to do in the first place, right? So we started with that. And like with that in mind, then we've actually been starting to find a few more places to do similar things. So, you know, another example is kind of similar to GitHub or other things. In a lot of cases, you have to define like which organization you're operating inside of, right? And so a lot of CLIs you'd expect probably, you're going to have to pass like an org flag or this thing's just going to crash and tell you, by the way, go get an org flag and come back when you have it, right? So we did a similar thing where it's like, if you run a command that needs an org, we get to the point that we're like, oh, hey, like we need an org. You didn't provide one. We know how to look up orgs. Like let's just look up the orgs for you and provide you with a selection list and you can choose which one you want. And then we'll just continue on our way. Like we don't need to interrupt this flow and have you go figure out everything. And like, cause yeah, I for one don't enjoy this experience of like, I tried to run the command, I got to the first error, I went and figured out how to fix it. I ran the command again, got to the second error, went and figured out how to fix it. You know, like, and six or eight iterations later, you finally have one command that you can run and it succeeds. But, you know, among other things, like good luck remembering, again, like the sort of magic invocation that it took to get that to work. And like, you're going to have to go through that same pain the next time you come back. And especially with something like what we're working on, where it's around certificates and stuff, like we hope in a lot of cases, like you're not having to touch this multiple times every day. Like you set up your certificates and hopefully they're like pretty good for a little while. You probably have a big problem. And so if it's something where you have to go through a lot of pain and like totally forget how it works and come back and have to just learn from scratch again, that's going to be a repeatedly bad experience, right? So we do as much as we can to really just help the user through it to like, you know, one of the core things that we're working on is based on setting up local secure context for development, right? So you can go to like lcl.host and see that in action. You can download it and set it up. But we really geared towards trying to have, we want you to be able to basically just run one command and the command will do what it needs to do. Like we will figure out what needs to happen basically to end up that like when you finish running through this command successfully, you have local secure context stuff set up, right? And you know, some of that's still a work in progress. I don't think it's totally perfect that that's actually what happens in reality, but it's pretty close and it's getting closer all the time. And you know, there's other parts to that too. Like it's set up where it's intended to be re-entrant, right? So if you actually run the command and for whatever reason, there's a few cases where you actually like drop out of the command because it tells you need to go do something first, right? And come back. When you run the command again, it looks to see the state of your machine and it can figure out, oh, well, we can skip this step because we can see that you've already done it. So we don't need to do that one again. Oh, but you haven't like, okay, now we know that you're right here. So like, let's continue where we left off and get you to where you need to go. So yeah, definitely. It's been interesting because obviously there's a lot of like TUIs and other things that are very interactive, but that's not really what we're doing. So it's like somewhere in some ways in between traditional CLIs and a full-on 2E experience. Like, I don't think we want to go to full-on 2E, but like within the CLI context, we want to, yeah, we want to help you along. We want it to be a more interactive experience. Like, we don't want it to just be, again, get all the flags right from the start or, you know, try again, right? We want to say, you know, let's really help walk you through this. And if we have questions or you need to answer something, like, we'll give you a chance in line to do that, right? I mean, you can also run it with all the flags if you want to, if you want to do the hard mode, right? Right. But like, I don't feel like that's like what is required of anyone, right? So yeah, just continuing to explore that, I think. And I don't know, I really like this idea. This is something that, like, kind of in some ways an idea that I originally had when I was at Heroku, even, of like, you know, we've seen in the browser and on phone apps and other things, all of these leaps and bounds in terms of how interfaces can or should work and how pleasant they can be and other things. And like, a lot of CLI stuff just felt really stuck in the past. And so there's been a lot of places where I've just been sort of like, hey, like, what can we borrow from those contexts where people figured out these cool things that are really compelling? Like, which of those can we reapply here? Not all of them are going to translate, right? But I think at least some of them do. And those ones have been some that have been successful for us so far. And yeah, I'm excited, I guess, to continue to explore that space and like, what can we bring to this? How can we make it better, smoother, easier, you know? So,
yeah, definitely we'll have the link to your article, which, you know, I went through it and it was sensible. Like, there was nothing I was looking at. And like, obviously I wanted to understand sort of why sort of kind of semi roll your own thing, right? As opposed to leveraging existing things. And yeah, some of the thinking there seems reasonable to me. And I'm looking forward to seeing what else, basically to continue documentation of this journey and whatever you end up with. Hey, maybe, who knows, maybe it becomes a new way of doing things or an additional way people can have as a sort of point of reference. At the very least, basically, you know, you'll have your reasoning for why you want to deviate from the norm, right?
Sure.
I do want to circle back to sort of the Ruby to Go transition for you in particular. How was that transition for you?
You know, better parts and worse parts. I mean, there's definitely, you know, in the Ruby context, I was much more comfortable. I'd been doing that for a much longer time, right? So just anything new is going to be a challenge. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, there's some big, I don't know, I at least perceive some big differences in terms of how the, I don't know, the philosophy, I guess, of Ruby versus the philosophy of Go in some cases. Like, you know, Ruby is about, you know, making things simple, intuitive, whatever, even if that means that there's, you know, 10 different ways you could do something because different people have different intuitions or whatever, right? Versus in Go, in a lot of cases, they're sort of like, no, there's like, there is one way that you ought to be doing this and we're not going to support the other ways, right? Like, that's seems to be pretty common, at least in terms of, you know, Go standard library and stuff, right? Or, you know, people will be like, how would I do this? And the response will be, you shouldn't, right? which is not what I would expect in the Ruby community, where, you know, it's more like, oh, I don't know, like, here are some possibilities or something, or maybe, you know, we'll even add some implementation to do that. And I don't know, you know, in some ways, I feel like they both potentially lean too far in different directions, right? Like, somewhere in the middle is maybe ideal, but that was a big difference. And then, you know, like, there's some stuff that you probably would imagine, like, in Ruby, metaprogramming is much easier. And so in a lot of cases, you do that more quickly and maybe too much again, but on the Go side, like, how much boilerplate there sometimes is like still amazing to me, I guess, you know, like, now that I have a, like, snippet for it, it's not as bad, but the sort of like, if this return value is an error, then do something else kind of thing that I had to like put everywhere was like, wait a second, why do I really have to do this? Like, I understand more why now, and it doesn't bother me as much, but especially at first, I was just sort of like, I guess I just put this everywhere because I've been told to, right? Like, not because I really understood what was up with that. And then, you know, there's other little things, like, I hadn't had to do pointers in a while and I still mess up pointers. I mean, I think probably everybody, if they're being honest, messes up pointers a decent amount in terms of, you know, do I need to dereference it here or not dereference it here? And, you know, all those kinds of little things. Or the other day I was running into, you know, yet again, this sort of thing of like, I was checking to see if something was nil, but like, it's always a pointer. It's never nil. It just might be a pointer to a nil or something, right? And I'm just like, it's like, had to have somebody else look at it and tell me what I was doing wrong because I just like couldn't reason about it somehow. So yeah, there's a lot of little gotchas like that. And, you know, just getting up to speed on something is always hard. And like I said, I think I had some particular troubles just because I really struggled, for whatever reason, maybe I was just looking in the wrong places, to find good examples of what I felt like were the kinds of tests I was looking for Bubble Tea, right? And like, that's what I usually do, is like, If I'm learning something new, I like to go and look at prior art, especially if it's a space that I'm not familiar with, to see like, there are smart people that have worked on this before. I don't think I'm going to come up with the best thing just off the top of my head, you know? So yeah, it was hard. And then, you know, like I said, when we then went off the beaten path, in some cases, like not having those examples to draw upon was tricky, but right. You know, we made it through. But yeah, Go is fine. It's different. I don't know. You know, it seems to be pretty good at some things and it's a bit of a pain in other things, but I mean, that's every language for you. So
knowing what you know now about Go, if given a choice, if the choice were yours to build this tool in Ruby or Go, would you stick with Go or go back to your roots, so to speak?
I mean, Ruby still has distribution challenges for sure. Like in terms of like, how do people install it and run it? And it's interpreted, so they're going to have that interpreter. And like, I guess if mine is the only Ruby program you're running on your machine, that's fine. But as soon as you're now trying to maintain that across potentially many programs and need different versions of Ruby, like it gets to be a nightmare really quickly. So not a good experience. So something that could be distributed well would be important. Go obviously fits into that. I don't know. I might look at some other, there's some other language choices I think that could fit into that as well. But Go now I have more familiarity with. So I don't know that I would want to necessarily start from scratch again. And, you know, like I said, even though we needed to build some additional things to get what we needed on top of Bubble Tea or whatever, like a lot of the core Bubble Tea stuff is really nice. Like we have been able to do some really nice UXy things in it, in terms of, you know, again, like the drop-down selectors for which organization you want and stuff like that. Like those are all just Bubble Tea components that I can pull off the shelf and use, right? So yeah, I think I would be fine with doing Go again at this point. I don't know. I mean, time will tell, I guess. I don't know how many more CLIs I have in me, you know?
All right. Yeah. So, you know, before we transition to unpopular opinions, is there any sort of a parting words, a recommendation that you'd give to, you know, someone or perhaps a team that is looking to embark on a similar journey?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple things, I guess. One is just whether it's, you know, CLIs or APIs or whatever, they can be really expensive. So look for cheap ways to do things. And so partly we talked about that before, like doing sketching, doing mocking, things like that. But another one that I feel like is not always obvious to people is like, I think for me, I feel like a lot of what I do is really informed by kind of trying to become a connoisseur of APIs and CLIs, right? So like I've made an effort to go write a bunch of API clients against random other APIs, like especially back in the day in Ruby and Fog, I wrote a bunch of IaaS provider stuff, right? So a bunch of different AWS services, Rackspace services, OpenStack, Azure, you know, like the list goes on and on to a degree that is painful to me because I still have to maintain some of them, but a lot of different things, right? But it's a lot cheaper and faster and easier to interact with and learn from somebody else's API than it is to make all those mistakes yourself, right? And it's not perfect, but I do feel like I was able to develop a sense of, I don't know, sort of taste by being critical of those, to be able to say, you know, I maybe sometimes don't even know exactly why, but I don't like that, right? Like, I don't like how that feels. I don't like the gymnastics I had to go through in order to write a client that would actually do that thing in a way that seemed consistent to me. Like something is off there, right? And it helps you to not walk into those things yourself when you're going on to design something. Like you don't get that many swings at making an API in your career, probably, because they take a long time. And, you know, most companies don't need a dozen of them or something, right? Like, you know, you just get a few chances. So whatever you can do in other ways to keep refining your chops, I think is really valuable. So yeah, I still like looking at other APIs and thinking about what they did or didn't do and why and how I might do it. And it's the same thing with CLIs. Like I learned a ton from looking at GH, the GitHub CLI, which also is in Go, also uses Bubble Tea and other things. Like I've looked a bunch of times at how they do their testing, for instance, right? Because that was much closer to what I wanted, but also very specific to their use case and has a very complicated like test harness that gets set up because of all of the things that they need, that I didn't feel like duplicating all of that was going to be a good situation for me, but still learned a lot from looking at it. I've looked through a ton of their code, use their tool a lot, like a lot of what they do, like not exactly how I would do it, but again, you know, you develop those senses. But yeah, like so do the cheaper things because you can do more of those more quickly, right? And you're not going to get it right the first time. And so If you're going to get it wrong anyway, do it wrong and cheap instead of wrong and expensive. I think that's probably one of my biggest pieces of advice, is just like work in that space until you feel a little bit more comfort and a little bit more confidence, and then move into the spaces that are more expensive.
Well, I'm here with a good friend of mine, David Hsu, over at Retool. Big fan of Retool. Big fan of internal tools built with Retool. But David, not everybody knows how to use Retool. What can't you build with Retool?
Yeah, so Retool is really good for building any sort of CRUD application where you care mostly about security, authentication, authorization, sort of internal facing things, basically. If you're looking to build, let's say like Google Maps, for example, probably you should not be using Retool for that. You know, go write some custom JavaScript or React, you know, in order to go build a really complex application like Google Maps. But if you're looking to build a CRUD app, Retool's great for that. And what we see especially is that backend engineers who have less experience the front end or less interest in the front end really gravitate towards Retool. Because for a backend engineer, sometimes all you want to do is you want to get a form type or database, test that it's working. You want it to go test an API, for example. And spinning up a quick app in Retool is so much faster than trying to go learn React, learn Redux, learn state management, learn all these different parts of the front end stack that has gotten so complicated. And so I think that backend engineers in particular really gravitate towards Retool for building fast CRUD apps.
Okay, friends, the best way to build internal software is by going to retool.com. You can seamlessly connect databases, build with elegant components, and add your own code on top. You can accelerate mundane tasks by not learning React, not learning Redux, and freeing up the time you need to work on the things that matters most. Once again, retool.com. Start for free or book a demo. Retool.com.
All right. Let's get ready for some unpop.
I actually think you should probably leave.
All right, lay it on us.
All right, I got a couple of CLI related ones. I didn't know how, like, if they would be sufficiently spicy. So I got a couple tries. We'll see if we got one. The first one, kind of relating to stuff that I've been working on, is like, I feel like for a lot of things anyway, kind of talking about the Linux approach, the like small sharp tools kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I feel more and more like that's necessary, but not sufficient, I guess. And so even within the context of like a given tool, so this is something that, like, again, exploring within our tool, you know, I mentioned this big LCL command that does all of the things, right? Like, not very small, sharp tool at all. But one of the things we did is actually underneath the covers, it's actually a series of commands, basically. So it's sort of like a workflow almost. And so I'm kind of like exploring this idea that, like, it's important to have all of those small, sharp tools, right? All of those individual commands, but having something that ties it together for the user in a, like, you are trying to accomplish this thing. I'm not going to make you figure out which set of 10 commands you need to run. I'm going to pull them together into something that's coherent. Like, I think there's a lot of value there that I guess I wish more things helped with in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, it's similar, I guess, also I think about this more and more in APIs. Like, historically, my inclination was to sort of be like, what's the set of resources I need to provide in this API? All right, I'll set up CRUD for each of those and, like, my job is done, right? But, you know, more and more, it's like, I don't think it has to be either or. I think you could have that, but also then potentially have some API endpoints that represent, again, like a workflow kind of thing or something, right? That actually pull together what otherwise would be three or four operations, because it's super common for people to do these three or four operations together. And why should they have to always wire them separately? And, you know, like, if that is something that people commonly want to do, like, maybe help them do it to a little bit faster and easier, right? And so anyway, I don't know how, if that's, is that like sufficiently unpopular? Is that like sticking out enough? I mean,
I do want to pull out on that thread a little bit. The, because sure. I keep thinking of sort of the example you gave before where, you know, if you didn't provide, you know, an org flag and, you know, sort of, you know, pausing to ask you, or rather creating some sort of interactive feedback mechanism within the CLI that says, you know, okay, I'm not gonna blow up, right, this command, you know, they like the whole you get it right the first time or I complete the exit kind of thing, you know, I'm gonna ask you for the detail and then keep going. To me, that's that interactive mode perhaps could be the default. But if you're gonna be a good sort of citizen, right, within the world of the, you know, small sharp tools and of the Unix philosophy, right, of basically, you know, knowing that I could pipe, right, the output from some other, you know, command, sure, into your CLI, right? Like, obviously I don't want the interactive mode in right, that sense, right? I want the one shot, you know, either get it right and I need to make sure I provided everything or fail, kind of thing. Perhaps if you know your CLI, if you're building a CLI tool that can be used or in either sort of context, right? One in the interactive mode, right? Whereby I'm the user learning to use the tool and you're walking me along. But if I have a more advanced use case where I expect all the values to be there, I know what should be passed in, I know what the flag should be. And if I don't pass something, right, I want that failure. Having that option, I think, could be the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah. And I think that this is one place where I've also butted heads with my CTO at times, is like, I totally agree with what you just said. I don't know that I feel like every command within the CLI has to support both use cases, though. Mm. I think it's quite possible that you have just a distinct set of commands, basically, that you're like, for instance, the LCL command that like is like everything and the kitchen sink, right? Like, maybe that just doesn't make sense to ever be run outside of interactive mode because it's just trying to do too much. If you actually wanted to run it with like all of the flags or fail, you're going to have to provide 20 flags. And do you really want to do that? Right. Like, it's just like impractical, right? Like, maybe in that case, we say, hey, we do have this nice interactive mode to really hold your hand and help you get through all of this. But if you're an expert, like, here's the breakdown of the 10 commands that get run. Like, maybe you just want to run those yourself, right? Or maybe there's some commands even that like don't have an interactive mode at all. Like, right. Like, a kind of analogy that I thought of is in the, again, the GH case, the GitHub CLI, they have all of these nice commands that do a lot of like nice high level stuff, right? But then they actually have like an API command where basically you can use it as a low level API client and tell it to just run a thing and give you back JSON, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like that's an example of like, you know, the API style commands are very low level. That is much more expert mode. Like, that's probably even too low level maybe for a lot of people. But like that kind of thing of like, again, it's like this necessary, but not sufficient. It's like, I want to have all the low level things that you can reach into and like just use those if you want. But I also want to have the high level things. But yeah, I think like there've been a few times at least where I've already felt like it would be so hard for me to provide a really nice experience for both of those use cases in the context of this one command. Like, do I really have to do that? Is that something I need to tie myself to? Or can I just say, hey, sorry, this command is intended to be really nice in the interactive mode, but we had to make trade-offs in doing that that make it not really work outside of the interactive mode. So like, if you want to work outside of the interactive mode, we do want to provide that to you. Here's how you go get that. It just isn't this thing, right? Like, it's kind of like a both and, not an either or situation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems sensible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your second take?
it's kind of related, but again, like relates to an argument that I've had with the CTO is that especially for more, I guess, CLI commands that have multiple commands, they aren't just like a one-off command. So something like, you know, like set or awk, you know, it just does one thing, right? So I'm not including those. I'm including things that are like multiple commands. I would argue that in that context, like positional arguments are just a mistake. Like, you just shouldn't use positional arguments in a multi-command CLI. And we've had like, boy, did we have an argument about this. This feels like more obviously spicy. So I thought this would be up your alley in terms of
unpopular. That's a good one. Stuff. Yeah, that's a good one. And I don't know, you and me both, I think we are in that same camp there. I don't even like initializing values and things like with positional. Like, I want key value. I want to be specific. I want to say this value for this particular property or attribute. Like, I prefer the explicitness because I've been bitten by so many bugs whereby somebody changed, you know, the order of things, you know, and all of a sudden some assumptions, you know, are now, you know, I'm doing the wrong thing because the value type happens to be the same thing, but you've changed the order of things and now the wrong thing is assigned to the wrong value. The test still passed because you're still passing strings where strings are expected, still passing answer where answer are expected. And then, you know, you're having these really nasty logic bugs that I've been bitten by that so many times. So yeah, definitely in that camp.
Yeah. And there's one other thing that I'd push on too that kind of relates to some of the philosophy that we were talking about in terms of how I approach this stuff, which is that I feel like when I'm designing CLI, other stuff, like one of the big things that I'm trying to do is transfer knowledge to the user, right? I'm trying to make it so that they learn what's going on, that when they finish successfully running a command, they're a little bit more prepared to successfully run the next command. And the problem with positional args is usually in a multi-command CLI, from one to another, the positional args mean something different. They aren't the same. Mm-hmm. So whatever you learn in one command does not transfer at all to another command. So you end up in this situation of like, I learned what command one and three are in this command. Great. Does that apply anywhere else? No, not at all. Not even a little bit. It's not going to help you. It's not going to transfer. And so I want things that are more transferable, and flags feel much more like that. So an exception even to like the multi-command CLI is if somehow you have something where the first positional arg or something could always mean the same thing on every command, then it's transferable, right? Mm-hmm. Then I think you're safe. Then I think that could be a good experience. But outside of that, just use flags. Yeah, it's a little bit more typing, but how often do you really have to do it? And that clarity and explicitness is quite valuable. So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm definitely in that camp. So yeah, but we'll see. We'll see what the people say. I don't think you'll get a lot of pushback on that second one. But maybe sure. In the first one. But we'll see. We'll see. Sometimes I get surprised by these things.
Me too.
Awesome. Wesley, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show to talk about your journey. And yeah, whenever folks deviate from the standard path, I always love to hear their stories, because not everything works for everybody out of the box the same way, right? So sure. Yeah, definitely enjoyed chatting with you. And I'll keep an eye out on anchor.dev and, you know, and the blog, and see if, you know, things pop up. You know, just, you know, drop a note. Let me know, hey, I've got some new stuff. You know, maybe we'll bring you back and keep digging into this. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, sounds great. Thanks so much for having me. It's a fun chat.
Thank you for listening to GoTime. We appreciate you spending time with us each week. If you haven't yet, check out Changelog News. It's the industry's only weekly newsletter that's also a podcast. One reader calls it so good, he considers it a competitive advantage. Read and listen to the latest issue at changelog.com/news. Thanks once again to our partners at fly.io, to our Beat Freak, The Goat, Breakmaster Cylinder, and to our longtime sponsors at Sentry. We love Sentry. You might too. Use code changelog. Save $100 on the team plan. Too easy. That's all for now, but we'll talk to you again next time on GoTime.